Thank you, Dazeen and Chris, for inviting me. And I guess I win the prize for the longest title. So I am not an entomologist, I'm a forest pathologist. And like many pathologists, I work on different pathosystems, but the one that's dearest to my heart is the Dutch elm disease pathosystem, which used to be considered an important disease. And my group is very much interested in the study of pathogenicity, but lately we've started working on other aspects of parasitic fitness in the Dutch elm disease fungi, and we're also interested in the evolution of these organisms. We used to talk about the Dutch elm disease fungus. Nowadays we talk about at least three different species. These are ascomycete fungi. The species of Ophiostoma ulmi was the species that was responsible for the first pandemic of Dutch elm disease that's probably started around the first, or a little bit before the First World War, and that lasted until the 1970s. This species is now considered an endangered species because it is being replaced very quickly by Ophiostoma novoulmi, which is a very much more virulent species, species with higher fitness, and which is currently the main problem we're facing. In Asia, there's a third species of Ophiostoma himal-ulmi, which is endemic, and which was shown by Clive Brazier in England to be potentially very dangerous to European and North American elm populations should this fungus move into Europe or North America. Now, interestingly, Clive Brazier, again, has shown that over the years, Ophiostoma novoulmi acquired a number of useful alleles from Ophiostoma ulmi through intraspecific hybridization. And this would include the mating type 1-1 allele and a number of vegetative compatibility type alleles. Okay, so in the absence of the Ophiostoma species, we would not talk about the Dutch elm disease. What we would talk about is an interaction between elm bark beetles and elms. And elms, and specifically disease elms or moribund elms, are highly attractive to female elm bark beetles that will breed in those elms. And the young adults that emerge from those breeding galleries will then in turn colonize healthy elms. They will move into the crown, feed there, and that's about it. There's no real negative effect to this cycle. Now the whole picture dramatically changed once these beetles acquired the first Ophiostoma ulmi and eventually Ophiostoma novoulmi. So they carry spores of these pathogens on their exoskeleton, and when the young adults, if the young adults when feeding carry those spores, they will inject the spores into the xylem on the tree. Well, the fungus will spread, eventually kill the trees, and eventually once the tree has died, the fungus will move towards the bark where it will fruit. So when those trees are colonized by female adults, the young adults that will emerge from those galleries will literally crawl through galleries that are lined with fruiting bodies and spores of the fungus. So then they carry those fungus and repeat the cycle. Now, we've heard about other ophiostomatoid fungi from Colette's talk. Many of them are saprophytes, but the species of Ophiostoma ulmi and novoulmi are true pathogens. If you inoculate them artificially, you will kill the trees. In fact, the Koch postulate was verified for these fungi shortly after the First World War by Dutch scientists. And for the sake of history, it's very interesting to know that all the pioneers on Dutch elm disease research were women in the Netherlands. They did all the first work. Now, you can also inoculate Ophiostoma ulmi and novoulmi to non-host species, and in some cases, you will induce symptoms that are typical Dutch elm disease symptoms, that is, wilting. And here's an example from work by Danny Rioux in Quebec City, who inoculated the fungus to pin cherry and got wilt. So in nature you will not see that because there are no beetles carrying this fungus to other species of elms. But who knows, one day if this fungus was able to get onto a different vector than elm bark beetles, we may have a problem not on different species. Okay, from the fungal point of view, there are a number of critical stages during its life cycle. One of them is when it is being carried by beetles, it has to resist a number of stresses, for example, desiccation, exposure to ultraviolet light, temperature shifts as well. When it is in the tree, it has to undergo a transition. It will spread very quickly in the vessels using its yeast growing form. But in order to then colonize adjacent vessels, it has to switch to mycelial form. So that's one challenge a fungus has. Another very important challenge it is facing is it has to face defenses from its host in order to kill it. Once a tree is dead, then the next challenge for the fungus is to get back to its vector. So it has to fruit in the galleries, it has to produce spores, and those spores have to adhere to the vectors again. Now, in the Dutch elm disease literature, you will find many studies on pathogenicity, and most of them have emphasized studies on secreted molecules such as toxins, enzymes, elicitors, or phytoalexins. Unfortunately, there are very few studies on the interaction between the fungus and its vector. Another thing that's quite remarkable is that the Dutch elm disease fungi are organisms that are very easy to manipulate if you're interested in genetics. And unfortunately, again, researchers in the Dutch elm disease world have, to my mind, have not taken much advantage of that, unfortunately. And if they had, they would have found that, I think it would have helped the work. Here's an example of an approach we use to map the genome. Unfortunately, we do not have a full sequence like Colette has shown. We've relied on traditional genetics in this case, but this shows you what you can do by doing interspecific crosses. Now, we've used, again, a traditional mapping approach linked to molecular biology to identify one putative pathogenicity locus in Ophiostoma novo ulmi. And this locus is located on chromosome 2. We, again, by doing crosses between selected strains that differed in virulence, we identified this locus. We sequenced close to 30,000 bases and found a number of putative genes. And we focused our work on one gene in particular, the MEP2 gene, which is homologous to a high affinity ammonium transporter in yeast, and which controls yeast mycelium dimorphism. And homologs of this gene have been shown to be very important for pathogenicity in a number of plant pathogens as well as human pathogens. We, unfortunately, were not able to knock out this gene by homologous recombination, which is, I would say, a problem with many of the stomatolite fungi. After saying they were highly amenable to genetic studies, they are not perfect. Fortunately, through a collaboration with Will Hintz at the University of Victoria, we were able to use RNA interference to knock down the activity of this gene. So Will was able to produce a number of mutants for us, including one mutant here, TF2, which has significantly reduced activity for MEP2. And when you inoculate this mutant, you find that its virulence is also significantly reduced. So we're currently finalizing the characterization of this locus. We're also about to start work with other members of this family of ammonium transporters. In good part because in other systems, again, these are the genes that have been found to be quite important for the transition and pathogenicity. Now, I'd like to address a different topic, and this is the role of hydrophobins in the fitness of the Dutch elm disease fungi, which has been a highly contentious issue in Dutch elm disease literature. What you see here is the structure of one hydrophobin, ceratoholmin, which has been characterized in the Dutch elm disease pathogens, which was thought to be specific to these species. It has since been found in a few other species. Now, for many years, ceratoholmin was thought to be the pathogenicity factor in Dutch elm disease, in good part because when you looked at natural populations of the fungus, you would observe that individuals with high virulence produce high amounts of ceratoholmin, whereas individuals with low virulence produce very little ceratoholmin. Well, one problem was that eventually, Clybrazier again in England found out that these were not individuals from the same species. What people had been comparing so far were two different species, and people were looking at correlations, but never really validated that work by sound physiological work. So first problem. Then with the advent of molecular biology, people investigated more directly the role of ceratoholmin. And Chris Bowden in Paul Horgan's lab in Toronto showed that was able to produce disruptant mutants of Ophiostoma novoholmii that did not produce ceratoholmin at all, and she showed that these mutants were still highly virulent to elms in artificial inoculations. In some complementary work, Brad Temple, also in Paul Horgan's lab, transferred the ceratoholmin gene from Ophiostoma novoholmii, the highly virulent species, into Ophiostoma holmii, the less virulent species, and showed that it did not increase virulence of the fungus. So strike two against ceratoholmin. Now, however, what's quite interesting with ceratoholmin is the way and also, well, the sites in which it is produced. And Antoinette Spirchev, a long time ago, we were really talking about pre-genomics era there, showed that ceratoholmin was produced in high abundance in the head of cinemata, which are asexual fruiting bodies of the fungus, and also at the tip of the long neck of the Peritesia, which are the sexual fruiting bodies. She also showed that spores in the head fluid of cinemata, again, contain a lot of ceratoholmin. And ascospores produced by Peritesia also produce ceratoholmin. Ceratoholmin was also found on hyphae. And more recently, Johannes Stadese showed that mycelium indeed, I saw that by quantitative PCR, mycelium indeed produced much more ceratoholmin than yeast spores. Now, Brad Temple, which also did some interesting work, he showed that Ophiostoma holmii transformants that produce high ceratoholmin produce spores that were more hydrophobic than the spores produced by the wild type. And likely, he showed that transformants of Ophiostoma novoholmii in which ceratoholmin had been inactivated were much less hydrophobic. He then did an in vitro assay in which he exposed elm bark beetles, Scolytus multistriatus, to cultures of Ophiostoma. And his results on this were very well correlated with results on hydrophobicity. So the high CU producing transformant from Ophiostoma holmii, which was more hydrophobic, adhered much better. The number of spores that would stick to beetles was much higher than in holmii. It was comparable to the numbers you would see in wild type Ophiostoma novoholmii, high CU producers. And again, a low or non-CU producer from Ophiostoma novoholmii would not adhere very well to the beetles. So all this work, which was initiated by pathologists who wanted to explain pathogenicity, really suggested that serotonin probably was not the pathogenicity factor we were looking for, but it was nevertheless quite important to fitness, most probably because of the interaction it favored between the insect vector and the spores of the pathogen. Now, I'll switch gear again and talk a little bit about pathogenicity, even though this is an entomology meeting. But this is some work that one of my students, Karine Plourde, has been doing. Karine has generated a library of mutants by random insertion of plasmids. And she's generated hundreds of mutants and was able to recover a few mutants with lowered virulence towards elms. And this was a lot of work. And one mutant in particular was quite interesting for us. It was mutant KP78, which harbors a single insertion, which we located on chromosome 2. And as far as we could tell some time ago, it had a normal phenotype for other traits, such as, for example, mycelial growth or yeast-like growth and other traits we looked at. So we decided to focus our work on this mutant, again, trying to identify pathogenicity factors. Now, again, the problem we found with Ophiostoma novoulmi is that you can generate all those insertional mutants, but when it comes time to recover the flanking sequences in the fungus, it is quite difficult. So in this case, we were not able to do plasmid rescue. We had to do a genomic library for the mutant, but we were able to recover, clone, and sequence a 15 kb portion of the genome. And then we ran into a bad surprise, was that we found out that the plasmid had inserted not in a gene, but was in, had inserted in between two genes. And we found six genes on this sequence. As I said, that's for students always a problem when you get into things like this. Now, Karine did quantitative PCR assays of these six genes in cultures that had been grown on elm sapwood agar medium. And we were quite a bit surprised to see that one of the genes, H1, showed elevated expression in the transformin, whereas two genes, H2 and UIB C, showed significantly less expression. So once we knew that, we went back looking at the phenotype, and we found out that, for one thing, the mutant produced longer cinemata than the wild type. Moreover, we found out again that the mutant, when you crossed it, it would cross if used as a male. But if you use the same mutant as a female, and I have to mention that these fungi can behave as male or female, but they cannot cross with each other, they are heterotelic. So when the mutant KP78 was used as a female, it would not cross, it would not produce peritesia, would not even produce a proto-peritesia. So this is an interesting feature, again, looking at possible interactions with insects and knowing that fruiting bodies are necessary for the fungus actually to go back to the insect. This is an interesting mutant, not only for pathogenicity, but for other aspects of fitness. So we're currently, Karine is doing knockdown studies of the H2 and UIB genes, as well as overexpression of some of the other genes in that cluster. And hopefully she gets something. The last thing I want to talk about is the some work we've done on expressed sequence tags. Very small libraries compared to the libraries that have been described by other people this morning. In our case, we've been concentrating in libraries from Peritesia and from Cinemata. We did not find ESTs for ceratoholmin or for the genes that were identified in mutant KP78. However, as I said, these are very small libraries, only a few hundred cDNAs in each case. So if we were to sequence more ESTs, it wouldn't be surprising to see those genes pop up. However, we found in those libraries a number of genes gene homologs that are known to be involved in the production of fooding bodies in other ascomycete species. And so we're currently doing work on these genes. We did macro array assays that showed us that a number of those genes that were indeed overexpressed in our libraries. This work has been confirmed by quantitative PCR data. One gene we're quite interested in is the mating type 1-1 allele, which so far nobody had been able to clone in Ophiostoma novoulmi. Our British colleagues were able to clone the MAT1-2 allele, tried very hard to clone the MAT1-1, could not, and it a portion of it showed up in our EST library. We were able to sequence the entire gene and show that it is very similar to the genes you find in ascomycetes, except that the Ophiostoma novoulmi mating type gene so far seems to be the longest one that has been recorded. So not only do I come up with long titles, but we can also get long genes. So to conclude, I just want to reiterate the fact that so far there's been very little work done on the fungus insect component of parasitic fitness in the Dutch elm disease, which is too bad, and I certainly hope other people pick up on this and start working on the system. Now, quite ironically, and especially from a pathologist's point of view, some of the genes that were thought to be very important for pathogenicity may in fact be more important for interactions between the fungus and the beetle vectors. Now, the ongoing work on EST libraries should also help identify now more contributors to fitness. As I said, we're very much interested now in studying the development of fooding bodies with respect, again, to this aspect. And again, in order maybe to attract younger scientists to this pathosystem, I'd just like to reiterate again that the Ophiostoma novoulmi is a very tractable system, and I truly believe that some of the findings we do on this fungus can be extrapolated to other species that are more difficult to manipulate. So again, the young ones, if you want a nice fungus to work with, here's the guy. Thank you. Oh, right, yeah. And the work I've been talking about has been carried by a number of people in my lab, and I'd like to thank also my collaborators, Clive Brazier in England, Colette Breuil at UBC, and Will Hinz at UVic.
I have a question first. I'm going to take my moderator's privilege to do that.
Ooh.
There's a little bit of recent work which I believe showed that the fungus actually helps the beetle by calling in more beetles, or helps itself by calling in more beetles to carry it around. Do you have any idea about any genes that may be involved in inducing the tree to throw out volatiles to do this?
Well, the volatiles, I do not know. I know like the fungus triggers the production of a number of phytoalexins, but which are not volatile. But yeah, the obviously, I mean, trees that are infected with the fungus must have a different signature. But I couldn't tell you more than that.
Okay. Other questions?
The beetles, the Molostriatus larvae feed on the wood of the elm. Now, will they penetrate the wood that has been previously infested by Dutch elm disease?
Okay, so the question is that would the larvae of the smaller European beetle be able to penetrate wood that has been infested by the fungus?
Yeah, will it feed on that? Or does it repel it?
I do not know. This is an interesting question, but again, being a pathologist, I haven't really looked into that, but I think that would be an interesting issue to look at.
Maybe one more question there.
Did anyone look into the mechanisms responsible for the fact that it's only this species of beetle that's carrying around the fungus? Like, why are they specific? Is it, you know, some of the genes involved for the stickiness, or is it perhaps bacteria or something like that?
So the question is do we know why the fungus seems to be specific to elm bark beetles? Again, I'm afraid I'm not having a very, I'm not like giving you a good like answer period, because I don't know, and I don't, well, I don't think people have looked at that. As I said, there's been very little work done on the interaction between beetles and fungus. And I said, and one thing that really struck me was again that work by Danny Rioux I mentioned. And if you look at through the web of science, you'll see that this paper hasn't been cited very much. But to me, it's a very important work, because again, in nature, we see a very clear association between two or three fungi and the elm bark beetles. But his work shows that this fungus would have the potential. I mean, this, to me, I've always looked at this fungus as an elm pathogen. And what Danny Rioux's work tells me is that it's a hardwood pathogen. I mean, it doesn't colonize every hardwood species. Danny Rioux has shown that. But it has the potential to colonize other species if it could only get onto a different vector.
Thank you very much. Thanks.